Good morning, and welcome everyone to our Ag and Uncertain Times webinar on volatility in agriculture. And I'm John Newkirk. I'm at Washington State University Extension, the Western Center for Risk Management Education. We'd like to thank you all for joining us this morning. We have an excellent program. We have two of the nation's leading ag economists, resource economists, to visit with us this morning on a topic that is high on everyone's list, our Ag and Uncertain Times webpage. And I'd like to point to that because last year we had a series of webinars, and those are all archived there and available for you to download, to look at. They're in three different file formats, audio and a couple video formats that you can use to put into programs. Tomorrow, we focus strictly on livestock and the livestock industry with Gary Brester from Montana State and John Hewlett from the University of Wyoming. And as we, just before we get started here, we would like to bring some questions on and have you tell us where you're at, what you're about, what you're up to. So if you could just quickly respond to these questions, it would give us some background on who our audience is and kind of how we should target these in the future. The first one tells us a little bit about your profession. You just click on the dot there that fits for you. And if we can go to the next pod now, this gives us some idea of where you're from. In the past, we've had a national audience, and we've tried to make our Ag and Uncertain Times series excellent resource materials for across the nature of agriculture and also the geography. So maybe we can go to the next pod, and we know that several of you wanted to present this to in a group setting. So if you could just click on here and tell us whether it's just you on the computer or whether you're viewing this in a group setting. And we hope there's good information here for discussion when we're finished with our poll. Dr. Sumner, who we're really pleased that Dan has agreed to present this morning. He's at the University of California Agricultural Issue Centers. He's the director there. He's also a professor in the Department of Agriculture and Resource Economics. He brings an exceptional background. He's spent time at USDA. He's served as chair of the International Agricultural Trade Research Consortium. He's done consulting work for farm organizations, government agencies, firms. He's been a frequent speaker at national and international conferences. He was born and raised on a farm, so he has the very practical, applied agricultural background from that perspective. And he served as the Assistant Secretary of Economics at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. So, Dan, without further ado, I'm just going to turn the program to you.
Yes, I focus on economics of volatility in agricultural markets here, and I don't use the word risk because it's a much more technical and complicated conversation, and we'll get to that after we have something to really look at. The outline and objectives of what I'm going to do in the next few minutes is to make the point that volatility is a natural feature of agriculture, and it's built into the economic system. What I mean by that is anybody in agriculture, and I'll repeat this line several times, anybody in agriculture expects volatility. It comes with the territory. If somebody thinks they can go into agriculture without volatility and risk, or any other business for that matter, it's just not happening. I'm going to show you some price slides in a few minutes. What we know is that prices are an input in the sense that they are an input to a calculation of net revenue. Product prices go along with input prices and production to get us income fluctuation. And we expect income to fluctuate much less than prices and quantities themselves, because prices and quantities tend to be negatively correlated. So in just about every part of American agriculture, unless somebody were off in really outside the mainstream, then what they do is shared with what their neighbors do in the sense of weather and responding to signals. And what that means is that big quantities cause lower prices and vice versa, and we have less fluctuation in income than we have in either prices or volumes. Let's go to the next slide. I just want to make the point that, so here we're seeing unemployment rates seasonally adjusted. These are monthly, just for the last decade. Agriculture isn't the only place where there's fluctuations. This reminds us, as though we needed it here in 2010, that people who work in other businesses also face fluctuations. This is just one signal, of course. Wages also vary, and people can be lose hours of work without being unemployed. But unemployment is the headline, if you will, in macroeconomic fluctuations. We should note that the last 20 years in the United States, actually 25 years, has had less macroeconomic fluctuation than the previous decades. In this sense, we've had much longer periods between recessions than we'd had previously. Of course, we just went through a very deep recession, but if you go back to earlier periods of time, those recessions were much more frequent, and a number of them were deeper. Here's some data that takes the wheat industry. Now we're getting directly to agriculture, and especially a commodity that's important all over Western agriculture. We're going back to 1866 here. This is the natural log in prices, so we've adjusted in percentage terms here. Put in real terms in the sense that it's deflated by the gross national product deflator, the GDP deflator. The fluctuations you see there are essentially percentage fluctuations, and there's a few of them that many of us remember. The mid-1960s, we had a huge jump in prices. In fact, among the largest we've ever seen in percentage terms, that happened very rapidly in the mid-1960s. At that time, a lot of people were saying that was going to last forever. Of course, it didn't, and we got right back to the trend. The other thing to note here, besides the fluctuations, is the long-term trend, and the long-term trend in wheat prices in the United States is clearly down and down quite substantially over really the last half century, since about the last 60 years, since the mid-1940s. We had highs coming out of World War II, and it's been really down since then, with fluctuations around that. Now, 2008, 2009, and again in 2010, we're above our trend line. Will that continue? I don't know. Most people who look at the long-term history say there's no way it can continue. These powerful forces of productivity growth will continue to shift wheat prices along with other agricultural commodity prices mostly downward. By the way, this same picture or something very similar to it would apply to corn or soybeans. For that matter, cotton is very similar and several other commodities. The fruit and vegetables follow a somewhat different path. We're going to get to that in a second. So the two points I use this slide for is to make the point that a fluctuation in agriculture has been going on for a very long time. Percentage fluctuations have been substantial in many periods, and the However, the recent fluctuations since, say, the high prices in the mid-90s has been substantial. So we are seeing a period, as most of us intuitively feel over the last decade or so, of substantial amounts of variability in wheat, but that's also true in other commodities as well. Let's stay with wheat for just a few more minutes to illustrate the point. What we have on this slide is the loan rate. So this is just the loan rate. Now, there's no target price here. There's no countercyclicals, none of that. And the point is there are substantial periods where the loan rate was the floor price. Some of you may be used to thinking that the loan rate went up or it stayed constant. This is in real terms, in inflation-adjusted terms. And notice we've only gone back, I say only gone back 3 decades here. The loan rate dropped rapidly. We know that in the first decade, and has been fairly flat over the last decade, partly because there's been relatively little inflation, and the loan rate has been tended to be fairly flat in nominal terms. Over the last decade, so since about the year 2000, there's been substantial price fluctuation, but it's been well above the loan rate, and as we know, we've shifted towards other instruments, some of which are like direct payments or just income supplements that tend to smooth farm income overall for wheat, and also countercyclical payments, some of which go to people that have grown wheat, that have a history of growing wheat, but of course don't have to grow the commodity now. Going forward, if we just look at production numbers, this is again just the last 30 years, we understand a little bit about what's behind price fluctuations. When you have 10 and 20% production fluctuations from year to year, even with our wheat economy tied into the world market, you're going to have price fluctuations, which is what the next slide tells us. One thing I want to point out here, so what we have here is deviations not from a very long-term trend, but from a 3-year moving average. So look back 3 years, how has has this year's price moved relative to the last 3 years? So you see 2009 looks like a big down spike. It was a 20% decline, but from prices that were well above trend. That is 10% up, 20% up in 2007, more than 10% up again in 2008. So that's where we start that decline in 2009. What you see here is up spikes go along, and the down spikes tend to be bigger and more of them, which accounts for the long-term trend. So if somebody's using the last 3 years, say, as where they think the normal prices ought to be, they're going to be caught in the wheat business, and which means people aren't going to believe that. Most people in the wheat business have experience of observing these things, so they know what's going on. Let's dip out of agriculture for just a second to remind ourselves that prices fluctuate in other commodities. This happens to be the one representative oil price over the last decade or so. This is monthly data, which is relevant in that industry as opposed to annual. And there we see an upward trend. What does that mean? That means oil prices haven't had the productivity growth that we've had in agriculture. The downward trends in agriculture tend to be our productivity growth, that is, ours in the United States, and productivity growth around the world. We know that demand is shifting out. Production or supply is shifting out faster. Demand tends to fall. That's built into the system. We know that's happening. I think in the long-term sense, we should expect that to continue to happen, though it depends on real investment. It depends on bringing more productive people into agriculture, more productive than previous generations, and it also means bringing new technologies and new ideas into agriculture. That takes investment. To the extent that we continue to make those investments, long-term prices in agriculture will decline, and long-term prices in some inputs to agriculture, like oil prices, are likely to be continuing to increase. That's been a fact of life for decades now. My guess is it's likely to continue, but it takes investment. So what if we look at wheat, and now I've introduced milk as well, and oil all on the same slide. Wheat prices have certainly been volatile. We've set here in this slide, this is a decade, we've set January 2000 as 100 And prices have fluctuated, and they've fluctuated up. These are in real terms just over the last decade. They haven't, the agriculture commodity prices haven't fluctuated as much as the oil prices have, and dairy prices haven't gone up or down as much as wheat prices have over this period in percentage terms, or that is relative to the index. Now, we do see real dairy prices jumping up by 50% and back down by about 25%, so I don't want to underestimate or undersell how much fluctuation there is in dairy prices. And so let's look at that fairly specifically. Here's some milk prices. Milk's the most important commodity in California and in several other states in the western United States, and of course important throughout U.S. agriculture, 10 to 15% of total revenue throughout U.S. agriculture. So milk's something worth spending a little time on. As you see, milk price, this is real milk prices, inflation adjusted. The price support for milk really has been a price support in the sense that it's a government purchase price. This is all milk price, that is what's represented there as milk prices, all milk price. The milk price support applies to Class 3 or manufacturing milk, and it's over the last three decades been substantially below where the all milk price has been. If we had the manufactured milk price or the Class 3 price, for those of you that follow milk, the price would occasionally dip near the floor, but it's not a surprise that the dairy industry this year, much major segments of the dairy industry has said, let's pull the plug on the price support program. It really doesn't do us any good anymore. We need to recognize that that's not an instrument that's doing much for the dairy industry. And this picture shows at least one reason why they believe that. The other thing we can see from this picture is that now we've turned to this three-year moving average again. Let me remind folks what this chart is. This takes the past three-year average prices, real terms, deflated by the GDP, all milk, and then asks, well, how does the current year deviate from that in percentage terms? And what you can see is milk prices really have become more volatile as time's gone on. People in the dairy business know this. I can't tell you why. In the very early period, up through about 96, support prices mattered. After that, they don't matter very much, and yet still we've had increasing volatility in the milk business, at least in prices. Some of that may be underlying volatility in grain or in feed prices, but there are other things going on in the dairy business, and frankly, that hasn't been studied thoroughly enough that we really know why that is. Me and other people have hypotheses, but it's a fact that the dairy industry is dealing with that we don't really yet have a good handle on. Let's turn to a few other commodities just to talk through what this means. This happens to be beef prices, and here we see much more in the way of cycles, that is longer-term cycles, in the prices. We also see it, of course, in production of beef. And so what I mean by that is 3 or 4 years of up prices. We're now in, up through 2009 anyway. We were in the fourth year of down prices. 2010 is above 2009 after really lousy prices in 2009. You'll also see these percentage prices in beef are not of the same magnitude as we have in the crops. That is, up or down 8% is a lot when it comes to beef prices in real terms. We get bigger fluctuations than that in crops. And here's now I want to turn to a few of the horticultural crops very quickly. Here's the real price of almonds, not down but up. We only have on this slide a decade or so of prices, and we've seen them go up and come back down again. So if we look to the moving average on almond prices, up. So the story on the moving average is well above average for 3 or 4 years, then below average for the last 3 or 4 years. But the big story in the almond business is that prices have been trending up while production's been going through the roof. And that's what this next slide is to make. And so what you've seen, production going through the roof, and new planting still coming in the almond business. And so the story there for fluctuations is not people worried about year-to-year fluctuations in prices, what we've seen here, or even 2 or 3 years. The question is, can prices stay relatively high given, I'm going back and forth a little bit here, given this very rapid increase in production? Are we ready for a fall in the almond business in the sense of very substantial reductions in prices in a long-term way? And that that general idea is something I think we ought to think more thoroughly about. When I said agriculture has built in a way to deal with year-to-year fluctuations and even 2 or 3 year cycles, and in some industries like beef where we expect them to last a little longer, that's built into everybody's psyche and everybody's business plan. But what about prices that go along at a high level for a decade or two and the bottom falls out? And that happens occasionally. There's really nothing anybody can do other than realize that that can happen in the business. That means savings and investment. That means planning for very large potential long-term price declines. And that is, those are periods in which everybody in the business scrambles. Can governments solve those problems? I don't see any way. Governments can contribute to making it worse. There are some very famous cases, the Australian wool debacle from a decade or so ago, where the government kept trying to hold stocks to keep prices high and finally just couldn't do it anymore, and prices collapsed when the government really had to pull out of the business. So I guess the point I want to make is not that this is likely to happen for almonds. Almond demand growth has continued. It's only that everybody in agriculture has to realize that even against a long-term downward trend, if we see prices well above trend for a while, we ought to realize that it's at least a substantial possibility that prices will be down for several years after we see prices go up. Same's true of the stock market, same's true of oil prices and other things. Wine grapes tell a different story than almonds, and it's also a very important commodity in Western agriculture, Washington, Oregon, California, and other states, and nationally on the East Coast some as well, and some in states like Michigan. What we see for wine grapes is, in real terms, substantial downward trend over the last decade, flat for a while, then down, then flat for a while, then down again. This is a part of dealing with world markets. Demand has expanded in the New World and in among Northern European wine consumers. I reference you to some work we did on the world wine market in a state of fluctuation that's on our AIC website. But the point here is, this is a part of specialty crop agriculture, unlike almonds, where we've lived with substantial downward price declines because of productivity growth in the United States and worldwide. We also know the wine market has lots of very special niches, and so that what I show here is annual U.S. prices of wine grapes. This doesn't tell you what's specifically happening to Cabernet Sauvignon in Napa or Pinot Noir in Oregon. Those markets can operate a little bit more separately from the national trends, which makes a commodity like wine grapes more interesting and more challenging than something like wheat or corn, which tends to move together in national markets. Let me move out of wine grapes, and the last commodity I want to put on the slide is apples, an important commodity throughout Western agriculture and throughout U.S. agriculture generally. Here we see a gradually upward trend over the last 20 years, lots of fluctuations in annual prices of almonds. It's something that the people in the people in the apple business have to be used to. They have to know that's coming. They're going to have 3 or 4 or 5 years below trend, a few above trend, and at least over the last 20 years, we've had gradually increasing real prices of apples. But lots of fluctuation, and notice here we're talking about deviations from the moving average on the upside of 20% or more, on the downside occasionally 20% or nearing 20%, with several years in a row of low prices. This is challenging to an industry. It's built into the industry. And remember, these last few slides, I've shown you industries that aren't dealing with government support prices or government payments in any sort of regular basis. Do they look a lot different than the commodities that have government support? Not really. Are they less healthy industries overall? Not really. And that makes somebody like me, who's been watching this for a long time across a lot of commodities, a bit skeptical that government programs are the answer to dealing with fluctuation for U.S. agriculture. The lettuce commodity is the one representative vegetable, and that's, the last commodity I want to deal with. This shows annual data for lettuce. We know that lettuce producers have several crops a year, which is one way they smooth fluctuations. Very gradual decline in lettuce prices, not statistically significant from zero. Very large fluctuations of 10 or 15% or so from year to year, with bigger fluctuations than that from season to season. It's an industry that deals with contracting, that deals with multiple seasons, and also diversification across crops. So the typical lettuce producer will be in several of the green vegetables, trying to smooth out big fluctuations and also take advantage of seasonality and other things in their industry. Let me stop there and ask if there are questions. I put our AIC website on this slide. We have background material on some of these issues that's available to everybody, as well as, of course, the website that you were given. We're also putting additional background slides related to this talk on other commodities up on the risk management website that you saw earlier. Let me stop there and see what we have in the way of questions.
Great, Dan. And just to reinforce, there are additional resource materials around these presentations on the Ag and Uncertain Times webpage. Dr. Sumner has a whole another set of, they're incorporated into this to extend the number of slides that are available there for information. One of the questions that came in from the audience related back to one of your graphs early in your presentation, and the question was, real prices in wheat trended down, but it's not clear that volatility has increased based on this graph in real terms.
That's exactly right, we have on our website, and I'll put on the risk management website, some more detail on both corn and wheat. I think I also have soybeans on there. Volatility has been substantial, but it hasn't increased for wheat relative to the long run period. And notice, we have some well known episodes in wheat. We have World War I, huge up spike. The Depression, huge down spike. World War II, an up spike. Then we have the 1970s. I think one thing to recognize is that the current period, this is a natural log, so these are percentage changes we're seeing here in terms of fluctuations. The recent period was a period, that is the last 15 years ago since the mid-1990s, has been a substantial period. It doesn't stand out on this chart, but we've had substantial increases and decreases of the last period. The message I get from this is that anybody in the wheat business knows prices fluctuate. Prices fluctuate a lot. There's no indication that that period has ended. There's no indication from this, if you look at the long swings, that we're out of what would be a long-term trend in price declines. The one thing that would reduce the degree of long-term price declines for wheat is if we lose our productivity growth. And let me use this as a quick advertisement for a point that I think is not dealing specifically with fluctuation, but it's incredibly important for all of us, and that is what's behind long-term productivity growth in agriculture is human capital growth in agriculture, that is better and more productive farmers, attracting people into agriculture because of opportunities to use their own productivity, and also the tools they work with, both biological tools, new seeds, new varieties, new chemicals, and also other technologies, including information technology like we're using here. The idea that a wheat grower, or for that matter, extension a person who's out there talking to growers, can be on this website rather than traveling around in a pickup truck really adds to productivity. Oh, we have to keep that going. Otherwise, food prices rise, and the world's a much less productive place than it has been over the last several decades.
I've got one more question now, and then we're going to go to our next presenter. But Dr. Sumner will be with us after we hear from Danny Kleinfelter to answer other questions. And this question's: Are you seeing any regional difference in either commodity prices or input prices across the U.S.? Significant differences.
Right. The big differences are across commodities, of course. Across regions, things tend to move together. The one example, so that is to say, wheat prices are relatively national. There are little pockets where the basis may change because of local conditions, say transport costs change, something like that. Some of the fruit and vegetable and tree nut commodities are specialized. Partly they're specialized regionally. Almonds are a uniquely California crop. They're a several billion dollar crop, but they are uniquely California. But when you get something like wine grapes, then you do get very specific regional markets. And we all know that some individual growers have strategies for, in a sense, making their markets more regional. We all know there are growers that focus on local retail markets, farmers markets, things like that. They don't tend to be the biggest parts of U.S. agriculture, but there are ways to make yourself more local. That can also mean you're more vulnerable to local price fluctuations, but some growers have found those useful strategies as supplements to selling into national markets.
Very good, and we'll have some additional questions for you. We're going to hear now from Dr. Danny Kleinfelter from Texas A&M University, and he's a professor and extension economist with Texas AgriLife Extension and Texas A&M. He's director of something called the Executive Program for Agricultural Producers, TPAP, and co-director of the Texas A&M Family and Owner Managed Business Program, and has been involved with the development and management of an exceptional farm management training program there. And he serves as the executive secretary for the Association of Agriculture Production Executives. We felt strongly enough about having Dr. Kleinfelter come and talk to us about some of the principles that producers can apply in a more broader sense, that even though he wasn't available this morning, we've recorded his presentation for you, which we're going to run here in just a second. You can still submit your questions. We've submitted some questions for him. We'll get him to respond to those and let you all know when he's posted his responses. But he's one of the best down at the farm level, management strategies, things that producers ought to be thinking about. So,
all right, well, good morning, everyone. We're going to be talking about managing volatility in agriculture. Dan Sumner started off with where we are. I'm going to talk to you in more of an introductory fashion about where we want to go and how do we get there, and then we'll lead into the more in-depth seminars or webinars following this one. Let's start off. A couple of things I've noted is I think too many producers treat input and output pricing as totally unrelated issues. And because volatility affects both sides of the equation, if you fix prices on one side without simultaneously addressing those on the other, it actually can exacerbate the problems. I think one of the best examples I've seen recently was in 2008 when Midwest corn farmers were afraid fertilizer prices were going to blow on through $1,000. Locked in fertilizer at $800 to $1,000 a ton, bid up cash rents, and didn't price their corn until the fall. And by the time the fall came around, both fertilizer prices and corn prices had come down significantly. But they'd already locked in their fertilizer rent, and it turned what could have been a very favorable situation into a pretty bad one. The basic point is, I've heard people talk about, well, I'm trying to manage my margins, where they lock in one side based on what they think the other side of the equation is going to do. That's not managing margins, it's just pure speculation. Let's turn to the next slide. One of the points I think we ought to remember when we're beginning this, most people think about risk management as minimizing the downside risk. One of the things volatility does, it also creates some very strong upside opportunities at times. I think your risk management strategy needs to focus on not eliminating the upside opportunity. What that likely means, at least in my mind, is that we're probably going to see greater use of options and insurance. The premium or transaction cost is higher than straight hedging or cash forward contracting, but it leaves the possibility to capture the upside. One of the big things about any risk management strategy is a big part of it is having the capacity to deal with change. One of the things I see people do, not just ag producers, but small businessmen and others, is they're so focused on being least cost that they limit their business's ability to adapt. I mean, it's like, let's be lean and mean, or the old notion, the British saying, penny wise and pound foolish. And you could look at some examples. You know, limiting staffing. I think it's really critical that there be some additional slack capabilities in terms of management skill sets, the capacity of the management team to adapt, and the bench strength. If you're operating on a bare-bones management team, you're limited in your ability to adjust. The other is from a couple of things on the financial side. In a highly volatile environment, working capital becomes king. The ability to absorb a shock and still play the game. It used to be the primary measure of working capital was the current assets to current liabilities. But over the last 20 years, we've learned that working capital or net working capital to gross revenue is probably a better measure. Initially, the general rule of thumb was you want 25 to 30% of gross revenue in the form of net working capital at year end. As it becomes more volatile, that ratchets up. 40 to 50% is probably more reasonable, and particularly if you fix things like cash rent or have a fairly high level of fixed debt service commitments. In terms of debt structure, there's been a real strong incentive lately to go short term because the rates are so much cheaper. At the same time, what that means is if interest rates move suddenly, and they haven't been lately, you could have locked yourself into a little real liquidity problem. I think it's important for producers to examine whether or not paying a slight premium to fix rates for a longer term. Think of it as an insurance premium, not just trying to get the low dollar every time. Leverage, same way. When land values have been going up lately, we've had pretty good profitability. There's been a tendency for some producers to push themselves out toward the edge and lever themselves up. I think you need to look at your situation and say, could I stand a 20 to 30% asset value shock? That is, land values, machinery, equipment, cattle prices, anything else. That doesn't appear to be on the near term, but do you have the ability to absorb that kind of hit? Capital debt repayment capacity, basically what we're looking at is net farm income plus non-farm income, adding back interest and depreciation relative to those committed term debt principal and interest payments. What's your coverage? Used to be we wanted to see 1.25 to 1. More and more I'm seeing lenders that would like to see that 1.5 to 1 in a highly volatile environment. The other thing, farmers traditionally, and for tax reasons, ease of computation, everything else, have obviously used cash basis income. I think it's critical that more and more people not change their basis for tax payment, but calculate accrual adjusted net income. There have been all kinds of studies and all kinds of examples which show there can be a two-year lag in cash basis income recognizing problems are occurring that would have been reflected in accrual adjusted accounting. And that's simply too late to make the necessary corrections. In terms of contracts, depends on where you are in the country. But obviously, if you're in a fixed cash rent area, the possibility of trying to negotiate either share rents, go to flex rents, or cash rents with bonus or disaster clauses, I think there's some way to see if you can get the landlord to, again, he has the upside, greater upside potential, but to share at least on some limited basis the downside risk. Over the past 25 or 30 years, I've had the opportunity to work with some of the best farm and ranch managers in the country. And one of the things I've observed is if you're looking at producers in terms of profitability, the biggest difference I see between the top 10% of producers in profitability and the rest, not of the population, but the rest of the top 25%, has primarily been timing. That is, when they get in, when they expand, when they cut back, when they get out. And I don't care if it's on investments, on commodity marketing, on redeploying capital, that is where you harvest your wins, cut your losses, reallocate funding. That moving before the herd just makes a tremendous difference. And just being a little bit ahead of the herd all the time. Let's look at the next slide. My points are this, that there are two issues involved. One, you've got to have risk management strategy and tools in place to deal with those things that you can't anticipate, the timing exactly. But the second one, and I don't think we do enough of this in agriculture, there's an awful lot of focus on the local situation or a specific commodity or what's happening in the U.S. I think we need to be looking a lot more at trying to identify leading indicators. Success is a relative thing. It's not some absolute. I mean, you're trying to do better than your competition to stay in the front half of the herd. In the future, those who are going to be successful will almost always be those who see the possibilities, that is, either problems or opportunities, before they become obvious to the typical producer. And as markets have become more global, macroeconomic indicators need to be part of your tool chest. For example, looking at things like political shifts, and I don't mean just in the U.S. Look what's happened in the EU. China, where protectionism is starting to creep in, or people are managing the value of their currency to try to encourage exports, or there are these additional regulatory burdens coming on. Those are all things that we need to recognize and have a major play on what the markets are going to do. Monetary policy, whether it's inflation, interest rates, I think a big one is exchange rates. And a lot of times there's a tendency to look at just the exchange rate of the U.S. dollar relative to the country currency that we're selling to. My point is that you need to look at the exchange rate, not just at the dollar versus a potential customer, but the exchange rate of the dollar relative to competing countries. For example, if we're competing in China with grains with Argentina, Australia, Brazil, we need to look at our relative exchange rates to those countries as well as how many Chinese units of Chinese currency we can buy. Global weather conditions play into it. Look at this winter or this summer's and fall's wheat prices. A big part of that was two things. One, the drought in the Eastern Bloc and the fires in Russia but also the fact that later on the corn crop was off here in the U.S., since in much of the rest of the world, wheat is a feed crop. You need to be looking at weather conditions at a minimum at the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, plus Argentina and Australia and Canada. Standard things such as commodity stocks and carryover use ratios, energy prices, I mean, what's the outlook for those, what's happening? Fact is, about 70% of ag operating expenses are directly or indirectly related to energy costs in this country. One of the things I think we get so focused on looking at our own businesses, when you're thinking about managing risk and looking at the impact of volatility, you need to be thinking about not just the direct effect on your own business, but what's volatility doing to your suppliers, to your buyers, to employees, family members, and to your lenders. One of the things that we've already seen, and it's been happening over about the last 3 years, is as risk gets priced into or pushed up or down the supply chain, risk management is going to be increasingly important to those parts of the supply chain with the least market power. And what that tends to be is the open market commodity producer. Just for example, fertilizer dealers that got caught with a lot of unpriced, very high dollar inventory in 2008 simply aren't doing that anymore. They're not, their lender isn't going to finance it. They're not going to be able or willing to stock inventory unless it's been pre-priced. That's a different set of conditions that existed prior to that time. Elevators, when they got the extreme margin calls in 2008, it isn't just their risk management internally that's going to be an issue. Many of their lenders are limiting either the dollar line of credit they can have to handle margin calls or the number of contracts they can enter into. You get to your lenders. Most of you have probably seen, in terms of interest rate risk management by the lender, that their ability to match funds has meant they're pushing people to shorter repricing terms or charging a pretty good premium if you want to try to go out very far in fixing rates. One of the other things, this is on the aside, you need to think about, I think, is with your lenders, do they really understand and they're agreeing to and committed to whatever risk management strategy you decide to pursue? You need to understand it. They need to understand it. The worst thing that could happen is to get halfway into the year and be positioned somewhere and have your lender get nervous and pull the rug. It's a communication and education issue on both sides. The other thing I'm seeing more push by lenders as well as some farmers is greater use of FSA guarantees. Now, there's a lot of stigma associated with it. People still remember back to the 80s, well, if you need an FSA guarantee, that means you're in trouble. The reality is that isn't necessarily true. FSA can also be a source of opportunity because an FSA guarantee, at least on enough to cover your margin line, for example, gives your lender a lot greater flexibility. He doesn't have to capitalize that part of the line as heavily. He gets less regulatory pressure from his examiners, and he has less loss exposure. You want the situation where he can be flexible, or if you have an adverse set of circumstances, that he's more likely to stay with you that other year or do any restructuring. There's another thing that has come up, in fact, is CoBank. When they used to talk about, everybody talked about the five C's of credit, has added a sixth C, in addition to character, capacity, capital and other things and conditions, among others. One of the sixth C, is counterparty risk. That is, what risk do you face from the other side of any contractual arrangements you're in, not performing on their end of the contract? If you pre-purchase fertilizer, what happens if something goes down with your fertilizer deal? if you forward contracted with an ethanol plant or with a grain dealer and something happens to them before the contract is finally consummated in terms of delivery, what happens to you? If you have a receivable, what's it mean? And I think some of the things people are going to have to look at as means of trying to mitigate those risks are things like bonded warehouse receipts, and make sure you know what that bond covers. Potentially letters of credit from a supplier or from a buyer guaranteeing performance. Third-party guarantees in some cases. Paying a fee if it's a large enough deal for independent verification and financial assessment of the other party to any agreement you're in. I mean, most of us don't have the ability or access to the information on our suppliers and buyers to really be able to tell what kind of financial condition they're in. There are independent parties out there that have the ability to do that assessment. And if you've got enough receivables, there in fact are forms of receivable insurance. They're fairly expensive, and they're not available on all types of receivables, but it's been used a lot outside of agriculture. All right, let's wrap up with five points I think you need to think about from just a pure business management standpoint in terms of managing these risks that are being accentuated because of increased volatility. The first is making sure you're doing what-if and sensitivity analysis. And all I'm saying here, you need to be thinking about what could happen, good or bad, and what would you do if it did beforehand. The idea of waiting until you're right in the middle of the problem and it hits you and then trying to decide, you've reduced the time you have to react, you've reduced the number of options you have available to you to mitigate the risk, and there's also a greater chance you're going to be dealing emotionally instead of rationally. Doing sensitivity analysis, you know, how much can you stand to lose? How much of an impact would a 10%, 20%, or 25% change have? I mean, when grain prices fell by 50% or went up by 100%, or the same with fertilizer. We used to look at these 10, 20% changes. That may not reflect the amount of volatility we're seeing in the market. And the idea of just sticking our head in the sands and using the ostrich syndrome isn't the way to deal with it. It's just like a general or a good coach in terms of scrimmaging or developing a game plan. The second one is monitoring and analysis. And basically what I mean here in terms of monitoring is staying on top of things. Looking at your budget or your plan versus what's actually happening, what kind of variations. As the year goes along, have the assumptions you base that plan on changed? And if they have, should you modify the plan for the rest of the year? It's all about timing, being able to capitalize on opportunities or address problems before they get to be too big. The analysis simply means going that extra step to drill far enough down through the information to identify the cause. An awful lot of people react to symptoms of problems and never address or figure out what the actual cause is. The third one I'd encourage is what I call decision autopsies. Some people call these debriefings. But basically, it's sitting down and looking at the results of key decisions, whether they went well or they went poorly. Basically, where were the errors in the assumptions we made? Are there biases that appear to be coming into the way we're developing our plans? Were there mid-course corrections that we could and should have made? What did we learn from the process? One of the things I find a lot of people have a bad year, and the obvious answer is, well, commodity prices were down or input costs were up. For the year as a whole, that may be true, but were there periods of time when you had the opportunity to take advantage of actually higher commodity prices or lower input costs? The fact that the overall market may be down over the year or at the end of the year doesn't mean, always, that there was no opportunity during the year. And that's the staying on top of things and moving when the opportunity presents itself. Another thing I'd encourage more of you to do is look at the opportunity to create peer advisory groups. That is, by invitation only, putting together a group of top CEOs that you can use as a sounding board. In effect, you're each acting as each other's advisory board, where you develop enough trust and sharing information to look at best practices to get, as I said, a sounding board for your ideas, to get some different perspectives. We all tend to look at things through basically a filter, and you don't want your filter to be too narrow. The other is to benchmark your performance, and I don't mean just financial or production performance. Benchmark your marketing performance. Benchmark your cost of production. Other things of that nature. And lastly, I think we're seeing a lot more of this, and we're going to more in the future, are pooling arrangements and alliances. What you're trying to do is, are there ways you could capture economies of scale, improve asset utilization, or find a way to employ or afford greater levels of technical expertise? Now, when people hear of pooling arrangements, generally they're talking about aggregating your buying power or selling power. But it can also be to take additional steps by going together in the value chain or employing in the area of, let's say, cost accounting or risk management, a level of expertise that would be too expensive for any individual firm. But forming an LLC and employing that level of expertise, which the group shares in the cost of but also shares in the group benefit of, I think has some real opportunities. We're going to get into some more things in much more depth related to grain marketing, livestock marketing, fruits and vegetables in the next seminars, looking at decision aids and tools. But I hope we've kind of framed some of the things you need to be thinking about other than just how do I mitigate my risk on the downside. All right, with that, I'm going to turn it back to our MC.
The first one, you know, I know you've done a lot of work with the top producer groups and stuff like that, and you mentioned this top 10%. Is there some kind of a distinguishing characteristic that you see in those folks so that they're ahead of the game and are doing the kinds of things that you suggest?
There's three things. One of them is the staying on top of what's going on. Most producers, I think, look at planning as a beginning and analysis as a beginning and end of your exercise, and then that's something they had to do for their lender for tax purposes, and then they put that aside and they do the job. These guys I've seen much more likely, and usually it's because they've got additional resources available to them or have decided to pay for the additional resources, have people, like I said, plan versus actual, practically on a daily basis, and not just what's happening in terms of historically what's occurred to this point versus what I planned, but have the basis for my assumptions changed so that I can make adjustments, and I think that's a big part of it. The other is just a bias toward action. There's an awful lot of people that tend to procrastinate. Well, I don't know if that, now at the time. When these guys see an opportunity or a problem, they move would be a second thing that I see a lot of. One other thing I forgot to mention, and this is becoming even more important, and I've mentioned it several times, but this idea of developing leading indicators, it doesn't help with probably the one-day, two-week timing, but the idea of shifts occurring that have major changes in the way the tide's flowing. There's a lot of people, it seems to me, are continuing to swim upstream when the current has shifted.
The second one is, again, this is kind of a broad category question, but in your assessment, in speaking to volatility, you've mentioned both upside and downside potential. What's your assessment of the actual upside and downside potential? I mean, if you could give a percentage of or a relative index of the potential in those things, how would they compare? Is it equal on the upside, or is the downside twice as great as the upside? What's your potential for the next short term, 3 to 5 years?
From a survival standpoint, there's probably more problem on the downside because you can miss some opportunities and still be around to play the game. You get hammered on the downside, you may be out of business. But in terms of just the way the markets have moved, I don't know that there's much evidence that it's a normal distribution. But at the same time, I think if it isn't 50-50, it's probably 60-40. I think there's some significant upside opportunities that we've been missing, and that producers miss in part because they're so afraid of what the adverse outcome could be that they've locked themselves into a position. That's, I guess, why I was saying, I think even though it means higher transaction costs and premiums, that insurance options as opposed to straight hedging or straight cash contracting can give you the opportunity to catch that. It's going to raise your costs some. But if you factor those costs into your break-even cost when you're developing your marketing plan, it will also leave the upside open to you.
Well, that was great. And Dr. Sumner, we have just a couple more questions for you. Your presentation, most of your slides presented a longer term or used to look at some smoothing characteristics, looking compared to 3-year averages. In looking at the information, the data, do you get any sense that the short-term moves are bigger or smaller than they used to be in terms of prices?
Except for dairy, there's no indication that we've seen that percentage changes in prices have fluctuations have gotten bigger. Of course, it has to be relative to something, and so it's reasonable to think it's relative to some sort of recent past or to a longer term trend. When we talk about fluctuations, we're talking about fluctuations relative to some norm. I think what we've seen for much of agriculture in the long swing is that prices, certainly crop agriculture, dairy, beef, is that long-term prices have declined. And sometimes we see a dip in prices, and we, of course, don't know whether that's part of the long-term downward trend or whether that's just a temporary blip down. One thing I do want to emphasize here is that I didn't talk about specifically about individual farm management strategies because, of course, we just heard a great presentation on that. But I do want to emphasize that I talked about commodity output prices. That's only part of the story. And we could have equally shown talking about fertilizer prices or gas prices or other interest rates, you name it. We know there's fluctuations throughout agriculture, as well as variations in yield, some of which are dealt with by crop insurance, many of which are not really dealt with by crop insurance.
So just to follow up a bit on that, do you have any thoughts on how well crop insurance or other risk management tools work to increase the volatility or to reduce the volatility?
Two things to say about that. One, for the individual grower, if crop insurance is available and yield fluctuations are a major issue, then clearly that can be a strategy that can help, particularly given a relatively high subsidy rates for crop insurance in the United States. What we've observed both in the United States and elsewhere is there's very little participation in crop insurance without subsidy and substantial premium subsidies. So I take that as an indication that in and of itself, yield insurance or even revenue insurance isn't growers don't see that as a major solution for them if they really have to pay the full cost. The reason premiums tend to be high for crop insurance when they're not subsidized is that there's lots of variability in agriculture, and if you're paying someone else to take some of that risk, you're going to pay a substantial amount. There are other commodities, of course, where crop insurance hasn't paid much. Now, that's from the point of view of the individual grower. From the individual of industries, crop insurance can, of course, increase the fluctuations in the industry. How does that happen? Because with subsidized crop insurance, you attract people into the business who have more variability, and that tends to create additional variability in prices. So that is, I have growers that wouldn't be growing a crop unless they could have access to crop insurance. They now do grow the crop. They have more, say, yield fluctuations, and that shows up in higher industry-wide price fluctuations. So it's one thing to think about it. Most of the folks here are thinking about it from the point of view of the individual grower. From the point of view of a broad public policy question, it's another issue about whether crop insurance reduces fluctuations for industries in general.
A couple of questions. I'm going to ask you two questions, and then we've run past our time, but this has just been really good, and I don't want to pass the opportunity up of getting your insights. We've had a couple questions about land and land values, and how do you see them moving in relationship to these? Any shifts or changes there?
You know, I started when I reviewed my slides, I put a big land values with an exclamation point right in my notes, and then forgot to mention it even there. So I'm really glad that question came up. Most growers, of course, have much of their equity in land, and land is a very important a backer for loans and other access to credit that can smooth out fluctuations. We know that bankers would want to see the cash flow, they want to see the profitability opportunities before they make loans, but land values are crucial for the long run for everybody in agriculture. We've seen relatively steady increases in land values. There's a case where, let me say it the first, if I knew what was going to happen to land values locally or nationally or broadly, I'd be too rich to waste my time talking to you folks. Because, obviously, so I'm not going to sit here and try to predict where land values are going. But what we do know is that land values have continued to rise, and they tend to move with commodity prices. They tend to move with potential profitability. Fluctuations in land prices, particularly large ones, can be devastating for long-run planning for people, both estate planning and other things. So land prices are a place where we are potentially vulnerable to very large shocks. We've seen that outside of farming, of course. House prices and other things have fluctuated, and people that aren't in a position to take to weather those kinds of large fluctuations, say people with mortgages and annual payments or monthly payments that aren't sufficiently hedged, are in terrible shape. That can happen in agriculture. I'm not confident that land values are continuing to rise. I really don't know. They could be, but I'm not confident that that is sure to happen. And I think there really is a potential there for substantial fluctuation looking into the future.
And one final question for you. Is the recession over? What's the impact for ag?
Yeah, the technical definition of recession doesn't mean simply tough times in the economy. It means the economy is continuing to shrink. So that is, recession means is the economy continuing to shrink? And the answer to that was no. The recession began in December of 2007. That was the first period we saw the widespread shrinking of the economy. And the recession officially ended in July 2009. That's a year and a half ago. Is the economy still in lousy shape? Yes. Could we have entered a second recession? That's possible. I don't think so. The most recent data suggests that's probably not the case. So let me rephrase the question is, when are we going to have substantial enough economic growth in the U.S. economy that it's going to substantially increase demand for lots of income-sensitive products back to normal? I don't see it in the short-term horizon. I'm not a macroeconomic forecaster, but I don't see anybody saying we're going to have the 4%, 5%, or 6% growth that will rapidly bring us back to where we were, and that will move unemployment away from the threatening double digits and back down into the 3%, 4%, or 5% that was normal when the economy is growing at a robust pace. That said, U.S. agriculture depends for a substantial part of its market on exports, and the global economy never did suffer a recession. That's because China and India continued to grow. They didn't grow quite as quickly as before. They have been growing robustly this year. So to the extent that we tie U.S. agriculture or you're associated with a commodity that's tied to growth, particularly in Asia, the market continues to expand. We see that, for example, in the beef industry, where Asian growth, opening of the Korean market, which we're all hoping for here soon, will provide substantial firmness in that market. It's also true that U.S. agriculture is not nearly as tied to demand from associated with recessions as it used to be. We don't have recessions that affect the demand for food like we had 40 or 50 or 60 years ago. Now, there are a few exceptions. High-priced wine took a hit in the recession. The beef markets, in fact, fluctuated but seem to be on their own pace, not tied to how well the economy is growing. So even a commodity, even a product like beef or even a product like, say, the demand for fed steers and heifers that go into muscle cuts don't seem to be tied to economic growth in the United States like they might have been a few decades ago.
Well, thank you very much. And I remind our audience that this whole webinar today will be up on the Ag and Uncertain Times webpage probably by early next week. And if you would send an email in to us, we'll let you know exactly when that happens. So thank you very much, Dan, for this exceptionally informative presentation. Remind folks that tomorrow morning we'll be back focusing on volatility in beef markets with Dr. Gary Brester and John Hewlett. A week from today, we're going to be focusing in on volatility in grain markets with Dr. Edward Allen, who is part of the USDA Outlook Group, and Duane Griffith from Montana State University, who is actually also our host, whose voice you've heard and who's bailed me out in this webinar this morning. And then a week from tomorrow, volatility in fresh fruits and vegetables with Dr. Roberta Cook, marketing economist at UC Davis, and Dr. Kinda Curtis from Utah State University. Again, this information is going to be up on the Ag and Uncertain Times website. You can Google Ag and Uncertain Times. There are recordings of webinars. The presenter slide sets are there, the list of speakers and contact information. So if you want to contact people afterwards, there's a wiki site for discussion of webinar sites. All of the webinars are up there as a video recording, as an audio MP3 recording, which you can download and listen to, or as a SWF recording, which makes it really simple to insert all or part of this in your own PowerPoint presentation and be able to see it. And this slide actually is that off of our website, and there is also tutorials on how you use each of these and how you can incorporate these directly into presentations. I've done that. It works well. It's great to be able to bring in someone like Dr. Sumner on a particular point and use it with your group. Another resource material, the MITnet at extension.org, one of the e-extension websites with information. So we have a file share window. There's if you'll click on this link here, And it'll tell you how to download that to your computer. So you can download that PDF file, and it's got all of these web links right in it. So I'm going to leave that slide there so that you can download that if you choose, if you haven't remembered. Again, with the power of the Google search, you can just Google Ag in Uncertain Times, and it'll get you to this information. And on behalf of our Ag in Uncertain Times team, who are all members of the Western Extension Committee, which are the farm management and marketing specialists in the 13 land-grant universities in the 13 Western states, thank you for participating and hope that this information will be put to good use. Thank you.